Hello, and welcome to episode 145 of Smarts, which as we all know stands for...
Several maniacal Arkhamites roguishly terrorize society.
Ooh.
Go ahead and finish the intro.
My name is Rediger Kupast...
Pasta Maker.
A.K.A. Trevor.
Hey, we're keeping
And your name
one.
Is...
Julia Guglia of Internet Fame Dash Podcaster.
We are also joined by Little Rediger Jr., who may make himself known.
Probably will.
Okay, so should we move on to the news?
Yep.
Okay. So you may recall that we've talked before about how DC and Warner Brothers are doing a new animated adaptation of the whole Death of Superman comic book storyline split over two movies. We've talked about this before.
Yep.
So with the recent Suicide Squad Hell to Pay animated movie released, the next in the docket is the first of these two movies.
Oh, cool.
So they've released some of the first images and some of the first footage and the casting details. So one thing that I didn't expect is that this movie, because of the, I mean, they had previously done, they did the Superman Doomsday version, which was a very loose, condensed adaptation of it that left out all sorts of stuff. But given that this is such a huge, important comic storyline, they've resolved to go back and make a more faithful adaptation, like I said, and split it over two movies. Given that that was the mission statement to make the most faithful adaptation possible, I did not expect that they would be fitting it into the continuity of the animated movies. You know, the Jason O'Mara, Damian Wayne, Jerry O'Connell playing Superman, you know, version that's been over the past, you know, 10 movies or so. But they are. It seems like a strange decision because you think that's incompatible, like the status quo of the characters in those movies is kind of incompatible with the truly faithful version of the comics where you have, you know, like flowing red beard Australian Lex Luthor and alternate dimension protoplasm Supergirl and Bloodwind on the JLA, but apparently that's what they're doing. So anyway, so I guess it's not going to be quite as faithful in terms of the exact characters involved as perhaps we thought, but nevertheless, it is going to be part of this, of the continuity of the animated movie. So what that means is that Jerry O'Connell is playing Superman. This will be, I think, his fourth time playing Superman. Jason O'Mara, Batman, Nathan Fillion, Green Lantern, Shamar Moore, Cyborg, Matt Lanter, Aquaman, all the heroes. Oh, Rosario Dawson, Wonder Woman, right? All the actors in the previous movies will be back in this one. Presumably only there to be trashed by Doomsday so the Superman can come in and save them. But some of the roles which have not been cast for previous movies in this continuity, or if they were only very briefly. Like, I think Lois Lane might have had one or two lines in one of the previous movies. But given, excuse me, given that Lois Lane and Lex Luthor will have huge roles in this movie, they've recast them with bigger names. So Lois Lane will be played by Rebecca Romijn. Who is actually Jerry O'Connell's real-life wife. And Lex Luthor will be played by Rainn Wilson. So those are the two big ones. Someone from NCIS is playing Cyborg's father in this, apparently, and then a couple of other smaller roles. And then, like I said, all the heroes from the previous movies will be voiced by the actors that have played them so far. So it's a pretty cool voice cast, and they, you know, released a couple of images, one of Superman and Lois there, and one with Superman confronting Lex Luthor. What's a little odd is that this continuity, because this continuity started when the comics were all about the New 52, is that these movies have sort of been setting up the Superman-Wonder Woman romance. But for this to make any, for this to be any sort of faithful adaptation, when this movie opens, I guess that'll be gone and he'll be with Lois, right? Because the way in the comics when this happened, they were engaged, I think. So, you know, so they're going to have to do, I mean, obviously the comics have had a huge change in direction with Rebirth, bringing back all those elements. The movies are going to have, if they're going to continue to keep pace with the comics somewhat, are going to start to have to reflect some of those changes. So this will be one of them, I guess. But anyway, I'm looking forward to it. I mean, certainly that's a great cast. And I think if they're, it'll be interesting to see the storyline done more faithfully and have, you know, Steel and Cyborg, Superman, and the Eradicator, and Superboy, and all those characters up on the big, I guess it won't be the big screen, but, you know, in animated form. Because there's been, there's hasn't been an animated Kal-El or an animated Cyborg Superman or an animated Eradicator that I can think of. We've had Steel. I mean, he was played by Michael Dorn in Superman the Animated Series. But yeah, but it'll be cool to see those characters for the first time.
Wow.
So, and you know, those are this looking like a pretty good cast. So yep. I'm looking forward to this now.
That's exciting.
The other news in TV news is that all of the CW superhero shows that we watch have been renewed for new seasons.
All of them?
Yeah, all of
Hooray!
Them. Which, of course, means, presumably, now we get Matt Ryan as a regular on Legends of Tomorrow.
Yeah.
CW also renewed a bunch of their other shows, so Supernatural.
Cool.
A couple of others. What else?
I think Supernatural is in, like, season 15.
It's going into Holy season crap. 13 now, I think. I think Jane the Virgin was renewed also. iZombie was the one comic book-based show, which has not been renewed. They're saying that they're... there'll be a decision on that coming soon. I think it's even more on the bubble. But all the DC-based, well, iZombie is also DC-based, but all the, you know, DC Universe-based shows that we watch have all been renewed.
Wow.
Cool. And they've ordered, what has some people a little nervous, thinking way ahead, this is really looking for the, you know, the fly in the ointment here, because this is obviously good news, is that CW has ordered 9 new pilots. But they don't have 9 new hours of programming to fill.
Oh, so it's
so
a competition.
So depending on how many of those get picked up,
right.
They might be looking to trim some old shows a year from now. And so after that, at that point, Arrow will have concluded season 7.
Right.
Which, and that's often when shows
yeah, seven
end.
Seasons
seven
and
seasons
a movie.
Is, you know, what all the Star Trek shows lasted. And oftentimes that's when original actors' contracts are up.
Mm-hmm.
And so rather than renegotiate, they just end them. So I don't know. Hopefully that won't happen, but it's a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
So should we move on to our comics of the week?
Yep.
Ready. What was your comic of the week?
Ooh. So I picked Batgirl number 21. And it's really simple because I like the father-daughter adventure story. So obviously, Commissioner Gordon doesn't know, or at least if he does know, then he's not telling. That his daughter is Batgirl, and they seem to be following the same perpetrator. And long story short, even though Commissioner Gordon is supposed to be home and really working on his off time to solve this case because he's super dedicated, he is following the same path of investigation that his daughter, Batgirl, is following. And they spend the entire day together, which means so much to Barbara, but... so much more to Barbara than it does to Jim Gordon, but there are certain things about Batgirl's mannerisms that remind him of his daughter and make him miss her because he doesn't know that Batgirl is his daughter. So, or at least again, he's not tipping his hand. Anyway, I really like the ending of it where they get together for dinner because they both missed each other as, you know, as father-daughter, a nice father-daughter dinner. And I like the art and I like the story and I like the interaction between the two. It was a really nice buddy cop kind of moment, and I just dig it. I love all the things about it, so that's why I picked it. How about you? What'd you pick?
I picked Doomsday Clock number 4.
Of course you did.
Which is just about as far away from
I know,
relaxy fun times father-daughter relationship as you can get. So this one, I was a little frustrated in that it didn't really further the main story very much or really feature the DC characters at all, but it still, that's not to take away from its quality. It was basically a long examination of the new Rorschach and who he is and how he
came
who
to
he
be.
Is and how he came to be, as they say.
Who he was and how he came to be. I didn't know about the Insanity arc. That was pretty cool.
And it features a pretty prominent role of for Mothman, one of the characters from the original Watchmen series also. So yeah, I mean, I don't have a lot to say about it, but it was just a really good in-depth character exploration of this new character. In a way that the original Watchmen series had an issue that focused on Rorschach also once he got thrown in jail and he was, you know, the whole, you know, I'm not locked in here with you, you're locked in here with me line.
Yes, I do. I love it.
You know, and then I think it was even that same issue where the psychiatrist who we learned in this issue was the father of the new Rorschach comes in and tries to give him therapy and figure out what makes him tick, and it's a whole character exploration of Rorschach. So it's fascinating that here we kind of get the mirror image of that issue, but with the character who is both the new Rorschach and the son of the psychiatrist character from the original Watchmen. So it was really, really, really well done. And I think you need something like, because I mean, to have characters like Ozymandias and the comedian back, we understand them so well from the original Watchmen, and Marionette and Mime are new characters, but it doesn't really seem like there's, I mean, they're interesting, but I don't think you would necessarily want a whole issue focused on them. But for someone as important as the new Rorschach, I think you really needed to establish his character solidly before the series gets too far along so that the audience can be invested in him. So I think it was probably a smart move to have this, because the original Watchmen, Rorschach's identity was a little bit of a mystery, and it wasn't until like the 8th or 9th issue, I think, that you got a character exploration of him and his past, because they wanted to wait for that reveal, whereas here we kind of knew fairly early on, so they could give us this information so that we would be more invested in the character as the series went on.
So two things that I'll say about this one, because I was surprised, and it may be stemmed from the fact that I'm a complete noob when it comes to reading comics, although maybe not complete noob, but anyway. I was surprised by the fact, by the reveal that Dr. Manhattan's actions and the explosion, the New York City event or whatever.
That was Ozymandias's actions, not Dr. Manhattan's.
Yes, you're right. I'm sorry. Ozymandias's actions in the New York City event resulted in so many people not just being hurt, but actually everybody who was hurt was also recovering from one form or another of insanity.
Right. I think if I recall correctly, it's been years since I read Watchmen, but I think if I recall correctly, there is a line in there either from Ozymandias, I think it must have been from Ozymandias, where he says that even those that weren't killed.
Yeah.
And even, I think he might have even said it was like a worldwide effect, experienced like some sort of psychic trauma. Because I think Alan Moore knew that the idea that a bunch of New Yorkers dying seemingly at the hands of some failed alien invasion in and of itself might not be enough to cause a complete cooling of the tensions between the U.S. and the Soviets.
Right.
It might seem a little implausible. So I think he added the extra layer of this global psychic trauma.
I don't think it was global, sort of, though. I think it was within the blast
radius. I think
radius.
It must have been, though, because...
No, because then nobody would be around to heal anybody.
In this, they... Well, no, not to this extent. But some sort of like low-level psychological effect that was worldwide, because it had to have affected the Soviets, too, for them to reach this rapprochement, that like basically everyone on the planet realized that something of huge importance had happened and that they, as a people, had been attacked. And that this was like a singular moment when they needed to chart a new course or something like that. Like he added this extra layer of everybody felt something that maybe caused them to act in a way that would have been otherwise a little out of character for them. I think, and this is, you know, one of the criticisms people have with Watchmen sometimes is it's a little unrealistic that the whole world would come together just because New York was attacked. I think he kind of, whether you subscribe to that or not, I think more sort of foresaw that. And so he added this extra element. It says, you know, sort of hand wavy, well, you know, people experience the psychological residue of what happened. And so it caused them to come together. So given that he established that, I think it's well within the bounds of the original text to say that those that were closest to the actual blast or whatever would suffer like actual out and out insanity or some variation of that. So I think that that's seeded enough in the original Watchmen that it doesn't really seem like too much of a retcon to me.
It from this issue, I remember it being more discussed about the blast radius itself because of everybody globally pitying the people that were injured, and supposedly their bodies were healed, but their minds were completely gone in one way, shape, or form. They were forever scarred by the events of this thing, Rorschach included. You know, present this incarnation of Rorschach included. So that's all I remember. I didn't remember.
Yeah, they don't go into the other aspect because the characters, the people in the world, wouldn't know about that other thing. That was Ozymandias's
plan was
to make people think that there had actually been a failed alien attack and that people were acting just out of their own compassion and sense of, you know, shared humanity when they came together and achieved world peace. Mm. It wouldn't work if the people knew that they were experiencing some artificial psychological effect that Ozymandias had planned.
Understood.
Even when his scheme was revealed and the world went to crap again, as has happened in the intervening years, we discover in earlier issues, it's not really clear whether they learned the exact details of what he had done to them. So it's still not clear if the people of the Watchmen Earth ever really discovered that they'd been psychologically manipulated in addition to the actual, you know, fake news aspect of the alien attack on New York. Mm-hmm. So, but anyway, it seems like that world was destroyed anyway now. So all that really matters is whether this new Rorschach character understands what happened, and it doesn't really matter because he was so close to the blast that he got the full brunt of the psychological effect anyway. The idea was that the alien, and this is, like I said, it's hands waved, but the alien had produced some sort of, you know, telepathic, like, because this was some creature that he had cooked up on, like, the deserted island or whatever. So the idea was that when it died, it sent out, like, this telepathic, like, through the force, basically, right? Sure. Like a million voices crying out kind of thing. And so that was enough to you know, to sort of wake everybody up a little bit and realize that something needed to change. And that was part of his plan from the beginning. So anyway.
So can I tell you the second thing that as a noob I wanted to mention to people?
Sure.
Read the backups. Usually I...
Well, sure.
When I read the backups...
They were essential in the original Watchmen, too.
I didn't know that, though. When I was reading the rest of the comics, sometimes they have previews or sneak pages of different comics or things that are coming down the pike, and usually I don't read the backups, but the backups of the Doomsday series are really important, and this week was no exception. The Mothman letters to his sister, who never wrote back, were beautiful and heart-wrenching and meaningful, and they didn't really add a lot to the story, but they did flesh things out and they did add a dimension to it that was really, really worth it. So if you're not reading the backups because you're a noob like me that's kind of used to just flicking to the end there, don't do that with this one.
Well, to be clear, we read all of the original story material in everything we read. The only time we don't read what you sort of label in an umbrella term as the backups is when it's just a preview of another upcoming series that
we're going to
read when it comes out anyway.
Yeah.
To read that would mean we're reading the same thing twice.
But I mean,
which is
when we read, I'm just saying that when we read Doom Patrol or something might be related in the backups, like
right. We still read them though.
I don't read all of them.
Well, sometimes.
Sometimes
you're right.
There's
occasional exceptions like weird, you know.
So as a noob, it's easy to get lost, is my point, because I don't recall, I don't remember, and I always have to turn to you to ask, hey, am I reading the backup this time? Because I can't really predict one way, shape, or form whether or not I should be. So I'm just saying, for anybody that's enjoying this one, read the
backups. Anyone who's familiar with the original Watchmen and read it, read it in its entirety, would know that those aren't... I mean, I understand why you call them backups. It's not really a great term for it. Like supplemental material might be a better term, errata, apocrypha.
Post-credit sequence.
What you call them. But I mean, anybody that read the original Watchmen would know that that's necessary material. That there's, you read the back matter in the original Watchmen comics and you learn all sorts of things about minor characters. I think that even like, I think it's only implied, it's only implied in the main story that Comedian is Laurie's father. I think it's only like, you know, like it's only if you read the back matter material that like a lot of the stuff is that's subtly hinted at in the main story is made
explicit.
Mm. So it's definitely essential stuff, and this is true for this as well. Like this one, like this character is now seemingly dead. So this just gives you retroactively a bit more characterization of him. But even in previous issues, I would say it's essential stuff. Like they drop the idea of the Superman theory in issue two or whatever.
Right.
And it's only when you read the back matter that you learn about, well, what that means and the global effects of it and what people were suspected of being conspirators in it and how Lex Luthor used it as like a rallying cry to turn everybody against metahumans. And like, that's essential stuff. Like you just know that's going to pay off in a later issue.
Yeah.
So if you hadn't read that, you'd be, well, some Superman theory? Why is everybody marching in the streets of Gotham? And you wouldn't really understand.
Right.
So
I'm just saying, like, long-time comic book readers don't need to be told this, but I am speaking for the voice of the noobs out there, because maybe some of our listeners are in my boat more than in yours. And for those of you who are, I'm just saying, pseudo pro tip, read the stuff in the back.
Right.
Okay.
So should we move on to your pop quiz?
I am ready.
So, in keeping with events in one of our TV shows from this week, I'm going to quiz you about cast member departures from TV shows.
Oh, interesting. Okay, cool.
Okay?
Yes.
So, number one.
Yes.
What was the name of, and you know, spoilers, I suppose, for, you know, people that left shows that we typically talk about.
Okay.
So, number one. Yes. What was the name of the creature that killed Tasha Yar?
I don't know. It was like this tar creature, which is funny because tar rhymes with yar.
Yasha tar.
Something with an A.
It was something with an A, actually.
I can't remember. It was two syllables. He was on the planet. He was all by himself.
Sounds vaguely like a deodorant brand. It was Armus.
Armus. Oh, okay. Do I get any credit?
I guess. Points? Sure. Woo! Yes, 2 points. You get double the normal for remembering the first letter
like
of
it. 0.2. 2 out of 10.
All right. Number two.
Yes.
What was Kes's seemingly final act?
Oh, cool. Her last line was like, "This gift I give to you," and she like as she exploded in a ball of light and entered some sort of new consciousness or physical manifestation of whatever being she was becoming, she shoved Voyager 10 years into the future and across and through Borg space.
Not 10 years into the future. They didn't travel through time.
I'm sorry.
She moved them
really, really far. Yeah, and shaved 10 years off of their return time.
Right.
And also through Borg space, which is important because they were no longer
There's more episodes with the Borg, but I think you get the idea that she'd thrown them past the heart of their territory
exactly.
so that every episode doesn't have to be about them evading Borg ships. But they're now like on the outer periphery, whereas before they were on the, you know, coming up on the inner periphery or whatever. All right, number three. This is from a show that we love, but I don't think we've talked about on the podcast before. In what state did Sam Seaborn run for Congress?
California.
Very good. Do you remember the name of the district? It was literally the name of an
47th?
Episode.
47th?
Very good. Yes. All right.
Ooh.
All right. Number four. In what city did Amy Pond and Rory Williams live out the rest of their lives?
New York.
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay. You're good at this one. Number five. Who killed Moira Queen?
Slade Wilson.
The famous Dallas cliffhanger. Moira Queen.
That's Slade awesome.
Wilson. All right. Number six. This is going to seem like it comes out of left field, but hopefully you remember what I'm talking about. What organization was Ryoji Kaji investigating before his death?
What?
You remember Kaji?
No.
You not even remember what series I'm talking about?
No, yeah, I have no idea.
This is from Evangelion.
Oh!
You remember the character Kaji from Evangelion?
No.
No? Okay. I don't know how much information I have to give you here. He was the stubbly spy ex-boyfriend of Misato.
Oh, him.
The sort of the suave secret agent type guy.
Yeah, okay, him. Hang on a sec. So what organization was he?
The proper context. What organization was he investigating when he was killed? Spoilers for episode 19 of Evangelion or whatever it was.
I do remember. I don't know, but can I get some
actually, but.
Can I get some credit for knowing that he wanted somebody to water his watermelons?
That's true. That's true.
That's what I remember. The sad part of his death. I don't remember. No,
the watermelons are eternal.
He was investigating. I don't remember the names of these organizations.
Well, he was like a triple agent.
Yeah, but he was investigating the Genji's.
Genji.
Yeah.
Who's Genji?
The main character's father, the one
Gendo?
Who was always
Gendo. You just combined his name with his son's name. No, he was investigating the shadowy organization that oversaw Nerve.
Yeah.
Do you remember what the name of that organization was?
No.
I'll give you a hint. It was German for soul.
Zela.
Sele was the name of the organization.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you'd have they hardened the S
well, this
if
is,
it comes
this
in the beginning.
German okay. translated into Japanese, translated into English.
Zela.
So.
Sure. Okay.
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 All right.
Do I get partial credit for some German? No.
You get no watermelon credit for that.
No watermelon.
All right, number seven.
Yes.
Who did Darkseid murder in Apocalypse Now Part 2?
The guy that looked like Jack Kirby.
Do you remember his name?
No. But he was a friendly, aggressive
reporter. What if I
tell
you his first name? He was a friendly what?
Aggressive reporter.
He was a cop.
Oh, he was a cop.
Maggie Sawyer's partner.
No, it's not helping.
What if I tell you his first name was Dan? Does that help?
Didio.
No. Dan Turpin.
Turpin. Oh, Turpin.
All
no.
Right.
Turpentine.
Number eight. Whose tragic life story, if you get this, I'll be amazed. Whose tragic life story spurred Jean to leave the Justice League and to another shore?
What?
The fifth season episode of, or third, if you count Justice League Unlimited, is a separate series of Justice League Unlimited.
You literally prefaced the question of, if you get this, I will be amazed. Why? Would you ask me a question like that?
I have to leave
then?
Room for you to surprise me occasionally.
I see. You're challenging me like a true professor does. Okay.
You remember the episode where Jean left the Justice League to wander amongst humanity? Do you remember what caused him to do so?
No.
What the example of what character and their tragic fate?
Oh, was it Wally West?
No. How did Wally West in the show have a tragic fate?
I don't know. He ran himself into oblivion.
Yeah, but then he came back like 10 seconds later.
That's true. No, I don't recall. I don't remember that particular one.
It was the tale of the Viking prince and how he had wandered forever, unable to die, and became increasingly disconnected from humanity.
Oh, that's right. And so Jean didn't want to do that.
I just remember Powers Booth relaying the the story to Lex Luthor while these beautiful still painted illustrations by Bruce Timm mimicking Joe Kubert's original art sort of passed over the screen. Mm-hmm. Just beautiful stuff. So that's why I remember that sequence.
That.
It was the Viking Prince. So they found the ship that he had sailed on.
That's what I remember.
And the Legion of Doom was after, like, it because they wanted to get immortality.
Right. I do remember this.
Yeah, Heatwave and a bunch of others were like thawing it out of the ice. Mm-hmm. And yeah. You remember the episode. You just forgot it was Viking Prince.
Yeah.
Anyway, you did pretty good.
Yay.
I got four or five.
Hey, I got closer to six. I got five and some number of points for the first question.
Right.
I'll take it.
So should we talk about our shows?
Uh-huh. Ready.
So this week we
Spoiler
have
horn.
Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Krypton, Gotham, Black Lightning, Legends of Tomorrow, and Arrow.
Mm-hmm.
So Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
continues to be great.
This one was great. They've really done some interesting sort of off... Well, I guess last week was shocking, but it wasn't necessarily off-format. But this was a really interesting off-format where they really hammered home. And it took me three or four repetitions to realize that all the characters were waking up in the same room.
Yes.
Right? I'm like, oh, man. This is what the show has done to me. And I understand why the budget is low. But the show is like, oh, man, another... Mm-hmm. Unfurnished room, another dark underground hallway, but of course, in this case, not in every case, but in this case, it was intentionally supposed to be the same boring, mm-hmm. dark underground room, because it was the same Hydra.
It's the same test. It's the same conversation.
Facility,
yeah.
You know.
She's running people through the same
I guess in
pieces.
My brain, I didn't realize that because I figured, why would this Hydra prep school be in like an underground bunker? You know, like it kind of makes sense.
It would
sense,
have
but
to be, right?
No, well, kind of. I mean, it depends how out they were about it, right, to the outside world. But that could just be a patch, or, you know, they could have not worn their patches. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, it took me a second to, oh, this school is supposed to be the same underground military bunker. Because I see people in a classroom with a blackboard. I don't immediately think underground bunker. I think, oh, this is like just a school
exactly
with
what
no
it was.
Windows.
It's supposed to have that shock factor.
No,
like,
I understand. Yeah, and then there's the dog bed. And then finally, when Coulson wakes up at the end, everything is gone. And it's just a completely Spartan room. Yeah, so I enjoyed that. The big titles, you know, whatever it was, two years ago, and well, first it was like 28 years ago, and then it was 2 years ago, and then a few months ago, and then finally the present. It's fun seeing Talbot again.
Mm-hmm.
He keeps popping up on like half
Poor
the shows
guy.
We watch.
He's just in worse and worse condition.
I wonder if part of me wonders if the reason why they had him wearing bandages around his head was because Adrian Pasdar doesn't have the same
haircut,
military haircut, because now he's playing. What's his face over on Supergirl, where his hair looks more normal? So they put bandages around them. Of course, he's been in the hospital for months, so it would be fine if his hair just looked different. But part of me are like, did they bandage his head and then give him like a long-haired wig at the end so they wouldn't have to notice that his hair looked different because he's playing a different character on Supergirl?
Interesting. Good catch.
Probably not.
Good catch. A little continuity.
But it was really interesting to learn. I mean, Hydra is back. Not really. I mean, if Hydra had been back, I would have been like, man, Hydra again for like the fourth order out of five seasons in some form. But the fact that it's not really Hydra, it's just Hydra is gone. It's just we've got like a few people that used to be Hydra until it was gone. That are now kind of doing vaguely un-Hydra-esque, like they used to be Hydra.
Yeah, it's sort of related.
But forming an alliance with like an outer space
entity.
Conglomeration of alien races is not like straight from the Hydra playbook. So she's not even really behaving like Hydra. She just used to be Hydra. She thinks like Hydra, but she's doing what she thinks is in the best interest of humanity, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
But she's, of course, arrogant, so arrogant as to not believe Coulson when he says that he knows how this is all going to play out because he's been to the future and so, you know, doomed to repeat their mistakes kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed it. It was fun to see her again. It was fun, not her. Who am I talking about? Fun to see Adrian Pasdar again. It was fun to see Reed Diamond again as I want to say Whitechapel. That's not it. What was the name of the
Whitehall.
Character? Whitehall.
I love Coulson's line of in response to her. Do you know who? Do you know Whitehall? I buried him. Go team.
Yeah, and then they reference Gideon Malik, and they reference there was a bunch of MCU references throughout this, you know, referencing the events of the Avengers and Winter Soldier. Oh, and you know, tiny little baby Baron von Strucker was there, right?
With called babysit. We both did,
that
actually.
Actor,
that
they,
actor,
they must have put something
kid.
Like in addition to, you know, the glasses, they must have, maybe they gave him like a prosthetic nose or something like them.
Maybe.
I think they must have done something to make him look more like that actor whose name I can't remember right now, because that was uncanny.
Yeah, the resemblance was really uncanny. And my theory was actually that it was like his son, because why not? Actors and their children usually go
could
into
be.
The same
I
profession.
Think if I'd recognized the same last name in the credits, I would have noticed it, but maybe he goes by a different name or something. I don't know.
Yeah, Nicolas Cage is actually a Coppola, fun fact. Anyway.
Right, you know where he got his, you know why he took that Cage? Name, right? You know where he got the Cage for his last name was?
No.
Because Luke Cage is his favorite comic book character, so he named
you
himself
mentioned
after
that.
That
to me before. Yeah. Awesome.
I think he actually has, like one of the biggest private comic book collections or something.
He's Seriously? Got
like for the first Luke Cage issue, which I mean, it's not that rare because it was only like 40 years ago as opposed to 80 like Superman.
Sure.
But he's got like this mint condition.
But still.
Heroes for Hire number one or whatever it was.
But still. Wow. That's
yeah.
so cool.
So Krypton, this one was called House of El.
Yes.
This was a good follow-up to the first episode. It felt Agreed. A bit more organic. Like the Adam Strange stuff didn't feel like... He just walked in out of nowhere to have a scene and then left again. Like, mm-hmm. it seemed more integral to the main plot. So something tells me that they wrote the pilot, like we talked about last week. Then they retooled it, reshot some scenes, added the Adam Strange character. But then by the time they actually went into full production and wrote and shot these episodes, they knew what they were doing. And so they had the Adam Strange character in there from the beginning.
Agreed.
So Brainiac apparently is getting closer. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed the scenes with what's her first name? Of course, these are new characters, so don't remember all the names. But the daughter, the Zod daughter, is it Lyta?
Lyta
Zod? I thought it was Lyta.
Maybe you're right. Yeah.
So Lyta Zod, it's kind of like a Klingon thing, right? Like she challenges her superior officer to trial by combat because
Which
she thinks
strange,
she's unworthy.
Which is strange because in this supposedly sophisticated society, they still subscribe to a rule from 1,000 years ago.
It's a little...
Because that's how they established it.
Like,
this is not something that happens all the time, but there is an old law on the books
I buy
which
it because
she's using.
Lots of versions of Krypton, and this one seems like it's one of them, have the whole... And we talked about this last week, too. Like their culture is kind of ossifying. Like they're more concerned with tradition and conformity and not rocking the boat than they are with actually learning new things or exploring or ultimately even saving themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that they would literally give their lives for some ancient tradition that nobody seemingly even people only vaguely remember now is kind of in keeping with that. It's interesting. I mean, so she did that because they were basically going to go in and shoot up the slums, right, where all the rankless are because they sometimes are sympathetic to Black Zero, and so they're all labeled as being like terrorist sympathizers,
exactly.
and they're going to go in and shoot them up. So, you know, you got some social commentary happening there. So Segel is going to join the Science Guild. He's going to have a rank, but he doesn't have to take the, what is it, Vax or Vanks or whatever. It's hard for me to...
Box.
Sometimes remember what they're saying because of their British accents. So I'm like, wait, what are the letters in there? Like, I hear what sounds you're making, but... so he doesn't have to take his last name. He just gets to be, I don't know.
Ranked.
He's just Seg, I guess, because he's not, doesn't have a house.
Like,
does he get to call himself Segel anymore?
I don't know.
We have a guild, but that's different than being part of a family, though, right?
Yes,
like, he doesn't
understood.
Have a house just because he's
still
part of the
ranked.
Guild.
But he's still ranked.
Right, that's
in
what
the
I
science,
said. He's
yeah.
ranked. He's part of the Science Guild, but he's not part of a house. So I'm not sure if he even, I mean, he can call himself whatever he wants in private and think of himself however he wants, but I'm not sure, like, on the official roster of the Science Guild, it would even say Segel. It might just be like, you know, Seg Smith
mark.
Or Seg Doe or something, you know?
Yeah.
Whatever their equivalent is. But I enjoyed it. I think the cast is good. I'm still, you know, trying to figure out people's names and so on. Like the bartender best friend.
Yeah, I love that guy.
Guy that seems a little Weasley, but looks like he's maybe on the up and up.
Yeah.
I have no recollection of what that character's name is. I mean, these are problems that'll solve themselves as we see a few more episodes,
sure.
but it's odd for me to watch a DC Comics-based show and not immediately know all the characters' names and their extensive history from the comics, because most of these are basically new characters.
Funny,
the fact that Superman's grandfather was named Segel is canon. That's from an old Starman comic by James Robinson, where the Jack Knight Starman went back in time to visit Krypton before it blew up. And of course, Segel, you're aware of the why James Robinson named him Segel, right?
No.
It's after Jerry Siegel.
Segel. You told me, yes.
So that's from that. And so I knew him, you know, obviously I have the last name Zod and a couple of others like that.
Sure.
And Adam Strange, obviously, but a lot of these characters are new sort of extrapolations of those famous families. And so what it actually reminds me a lot of is Kevin J. Anderson, who wrote a lot of Star Wars stuff and a lot of other tie-in fiction, did a novel called The Last Days of Krypton that I read, maybe 10 years ago, 12 years ago. And it was great. It was like, it told the story of Jor-El and Lara meeting, falling in love, having a baby, and the destruction of Krypton and the rise of General Zod and all that. So it like covered the last few years of Krypton. It was kind of like the fall of Rome kind of thing, you know, like it was, it looked at all the different aspects of society and you know, it was really well done. So if people that are enjoying Krypton might want to go back and read. It has a similar tone, but it was really well done. The Last Days of Krypton was the name of the novel. I'm not sure if it's still in print or not, but it's probably get it on Amazon or something. So Gotham this week.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a big villain-heavy episode. We've
dun,
got
dun, dun.
We've got Jerome, we've got Mad Hatter, and Scarecrow. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if it's happened yet. Maybe the fact that he was under the hood the whole time is there to sort of ease the transition, but apparently they recast Scarecrow.
Oh,
which is odd, because they had that actor in like one episode in the first season.
Yeah.
And then they brought the same actor back to play him again like 3 years later.
For
a few episodes, and then they recast. Like, you think if you were going to recast, that 3 year gap is the perfect time to do it, because people are only going to even vaguely remember what the first guy looked like.
Yep.
But I remember thinking, oh, it's interesting that they got the same guy back, because it was such a minor one-off role in the first season.
Exactly.
If you know you're going to make him a major villain, I'm surprised that now. But so apparently I don't know if it was the new guy under the hood in this one.
Right.
Or maybe he's never going to take the hood off.
Right.
And so to the audience, it's invisible
irrelevant.
That it's a different guy. Sure. It's just, you know, it might be a different voice, and maybe that's a different actor doing the VO. I don't know. But anyway, just a minor thing. I was curious, what did you think of, because I know that you were a little on the fence about the Mad Hatter portrayal earlier, because you felt that he was, not quite like empathetic or erudite enough. Like, he seemed more of just like a crazy.
Yes.
Maybe I'm putting words in your mouth, but I seem to think you thought he was more of just like a crazy psychopath than the more gentle. I mean, he was still doing terrible things, but like the more gentle Roddy McDowall version from the animated series.
Roddy McDowall nailed it. He was actually empathetic and intelligent. So
right.
You have
but
person who seems to be normal, who seems to be capable of connecting with the rest of the world successfully, but he regards himself to be elite and intelligent and justified in doing some weird and horrible things, but in an intelligent way. So he's developed this method of mind control, which is a very sophisticated bit of science, and he understands exactly what he's doing. He's a sociopath, but he's, you know, normal, seemingly normal. And this performance here in Gotham was sort of insane. It's like, for some reason, some magical power imbues him with the ability to talk people into doing.
Well, he's a hypnotist.
Yeah.
I feel like if you want to do like a proto version of the Mad Hatter, he doesn't have the mind controlling hat or like playing card, not sure. Playing cards, but like the whatever technology.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, he's just a hypnotist. Like, if you want to regress him to a proto version. Anyway, the reason why I bring it up, and you're not wrong, but I feel like, again, if you're going to hold the writing and acting and characterization of every Gotham character to the Batman the Animated Series standard, you're going to be disappointed.
Yeah, I'm just remembering my comments from my first impression.
I thought that he was better in this episode than he has been in the past. I don't know if it was the writing or the actor or what, but I thought he had the way they sort of laced his lines with more rhyming.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they weren't. Yeah. I don't think they were Lewis Carroll quotes specifically.
No,
but he seemed. He was still like dangerous and crazy, but he seemed a little quirkier here, more distinct, I should say. Like, in his method of crazy, his brand of craziness here was more distinct and more evocative of the Mad Hatter character that I know from the comics than before, where he just seemed like a hypnotist, psychopath character who, you know what I mean? Who might have worn the hat, but didn't really seem like he had that. Here, it seems like this seems like a natural, if you think of like the tone and the style of the Gotham TV series, and the sort of like the uber violent yet somewhat like macabre yet somewhat over the top tone of the show. Like, this seems like more like what I would have imagined a Mad Hatter version in Gotham to be like, as opposed to the version we got before. And maybe that's intentional. Maybe they're like, as they are with, say, Jerome or Riddler or whatever, maybe they are intentionally, and Scarecrow, evolving those early versions of the characters into characters that are more recognizable as you would expect to happen. You know, as the series goes on, the characters become closer to what they will be when Batman ultimately fights them, you know. Or maybe I'm giving them too much credit. Anyway, did you think that Mad Hatter came off more
interesting? There were some moments where
it was not interesting necessarily, but more distinct, more compelling perhaps in this episode.
So I appreciate that he was rhyming almost all the time, but at some point I didn't buy it, because somebody that unhinged can't plan their words that carefully, that successfully, I'm going to say. It takes a lot of work to rhyme. So there's no way that I could buy into the fact that somebody completely off their rocker like this can rhyme in their speech, because that takes way too much work to do. There's no talent that I don't know of any wires in the brain that can make you rhyme as an instinct, as a form of instinct, you know. So I wasn't really buying into that Etrigan level of rhyming. Not all the time, anyway. And there were a couple moments where I was really brought out of the story by the crazy choices that the actor was, or the director, I don't know who, but there were some moments where he flared up with emotion, like insane emotion, for no reason, without... It was just too much for me. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. He seemed like he would just explode periodically.
For
just,
no reason.
Just vent. Well, I mean, the reason is that he's crazy. No, sure. I understand what you're saying. And it did seem like that was not a quirk of his in the earlier episodes. But again, like, he's getting worse.
If you're that level...
Like, these characters are all supposed to be getting worse.
Understood. So. But if you're that level of sick, then I don't think that you can function part of a team and executing a plan, which is what the Mad Hatter was
medical,
doing.
Psychological realism in any Batman story, or specifically this one, I think you're probably going to be disappointed. It's like an over-the-top cartoonish characterization
of criminal
insane. Good
Batman stories have that balance.
I know, but
you know
this
what
is
I
not
mean?
That kind of story.
Yes.
Not to say that it's not good, but it's just more over the top, and it's
I liked
a little
him
more
better.
Surface level than that.
To answer your question originally, I liked him better in this performance, in this episode. You're right that the writing, so something about the writing and the performances was better than the first time that I saw him. So I like him better now, but I still don't like this incarnation. I still don't like this incarnation.
All I was saying
is
that he seemed more distinct in the way that, say, the Mr. Freeze character still doesn't, where he just seems like generic bad guy who happens to be called Victor Freeze.
Right.
Did you notice, 100%. This is non sequitur, but a couple of episodes ago, Nigma called him Victor Freeze instead of Victor Fries, which they've been consistent. Like, I don't.
Oh, yeah, they have been.
I prefer Victor Freeze, but it's not consistent. There's no reason why. If you want to call him Mr. Freeze, if his name is Victor Fries, but you want to call him Mr. Freeze as his supervillain name, that's fine. But there's no reason in this show, as they've established, to call him Victor Freeze.
Right.
Unless he was being cute, like
as
Victor quote unquote Freeze.
Sure.
You know, maybe, I don't know. It might have just been a little error that nobody caught. Yeah, but I enjoyed it. Did you notice that Ben McKenzie directed this one?
I did.
Yeah.
I did. I kind of gave you
job.
An elbow. I was like, ooh.
He did a good job. I thought that there was genuine tension. Sometimes the show is so over the top that I don't feel like a lot. They're telling me there are stakes, but I'm not necessarily feeling them all the time.
I'm actually
but the thing with
impressed.
All the people on the roofs
so
on.
Oh, yeah, that was great.
And then he goes to the radio station and everything, and he can't figure out how to get them to stop, and he comes up with the inspiration to tell them to save each other. Like, I thought that was all really well done. Like,
I thought so
and that's
too.
In the directing and the
so
writing.
Like,
that was actually
solution.
Paced and shot very well that you would, you know, you felt that tension and that desperation.
Did you?
And when Bullock locks himself in the car.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, like that. No, I thought that there were actual, like, genuine moments of tension and desperation in this.
I have a question. When in the radio station, when, oh my God, Jim Gordon was going to say a line that supposedly fixes everything. Were you playing a game in your head the same as I was about trying to guess what he was going to say?
Well, I told you at the time I thought he was going to say, everybody save the person next to you.
Yes.
I thought that he would have to be that specific, that just say save each other wouldn't, I mean, who knows how hypnotism,
sure.
Like, I didn't know if that would be granular enough. To register as like an explicit command in the minds of these hypnotized people.
I have
each other, like what if two like what I mean is it's so nonspecific. What if two people both go to save the same person, right?
Yes.
And then another person falls because you know like if you were specific like everybody save the person on your right, everybody gets saved.
Except for that poor schmuck
for the guy
left.
On the left end. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know acceptable losses. But if everybody just like everybody save. What if everybody goes to go save one person and then everybody else?
You
falls,
know what
so,
I was
whatever.
Thinking. I was thinking that if you can't tell them not to jump and you can't tell them not to, you know, to save themselves, then the best next best thing would be to tell them to turn around.
Yeah.
So that when they jumped,
I guess it depends on what the command was, right? If the command was just jump, then yes, that would work. But if the command was jump off the roof to your death,
right.
Then that wouldn't work because it would conflict with that original instruction or they would turn, like Gordon said,
and then
but then they would
backwards.
Just turn around again and jump off. Like, it depends on what
yeah.
the original command was. And anyway, you know, we can obviously overanalyze it. But I enjoyed the episode.
Yeah, it was fun.
So Black Lightning this week was also good.
Oh, wait, we didn't mention anything about the Barbara hand.
Oh, the Ra's al Ghul
stuff? The
Ra's
al Ghul stuff, the demon's head.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
She's now in charge of, like, an all-female League of Shadows.
I dig it.
I guess.
Hashtag feminism.
The fact is, some League of Assassins in some versions and League of Shadows in other versions always confuse. I understand why it is, but it confuses me sometimes when I'm like, wait, which one is it in this version? And then in the comics, now there's both versions. So
yeah.
I don't know. But I enjoyed it.
I liked it.
I enjoyed all that.
Me too.
But I was a little confused that, I mean, maybe they'll clarify it, but I mean, Ra's al Ghul was not supposed to have been the first Ra's al Ghul. Like, that's a title that got passed down.
Yep.
So when they're talking to Barbara and they're saying, oh, Ra's al Ghul made you the new demon's head, I was like, wait, shouldn't you be calling her Ra's al Ghul now? Yep. Like, maybe after they accept her, they will. But I was, the fact that they kept calling the old guy Ra's al Ghul, but just referring to her as Barbara or Ms. Keen or whatever, was like, wait, shouldn't you, you know, I get that it would be confusing in conversation to just be referring to multiple people as Ra's al Ghul.
Yeah.
But anyway.
It's like calling somebody the president. Well, which president?
I'm still amazed that they got Alexander Siddig to appear like as an actual character in only like 3 or 4 episodes, and then just a few more times, seemingly in like visions and flashbacks and dream sequences.
Yeah,
but he was able to get them to agree to make him a regular, and like, which basically means you're paid for basically every episode.
Hey, you know what?
Like, that's crazy.
First thing I'll mention is that his name has that kind of firepower, and second thing, well, his agent must be awesome.
Us it does, but I mean,
hey, to us it does, yeah.
I mean, people that were on Star Trek 20 years ago and have done a few things since, he's actually been more successful after Deep Space Nine than most of the other actors on Deep Space Nine, but still, I mean, to us as huge Star Trek fans, it's awesome, but to most people and to, like, you know, Hollywood or whatever, I'm not sure that he's a huge name necessarily, that he would rank that kind.
We should check his ranking in IMDb.
In the way that if Leonard Nimoy was on your show, you know, that's a big deal because everybody knows who that is. But Deep Space Nine, not as many people watch and not as many people remember, you know, and it's not like he was even the star of that show. So anyway.
Who would you say was the star of that show?
Well, the captain is traditionally the star of, until you get to Discovery, of course. But okay, the captain is always credited first. It's always starring Avery Brooks, then also starring everybody else.
Okay.
That's always the way it goes.
I just thought it was alphabetical because his last name is Brooks. Like, it is for Catherine Janeway, for example.
No, but if you
look, now we're getting really into the geeky weeds, everybody.
If you look closely on all the Star Trek shows, starting with Next Gen anyway, it was always starring and then whoever plays the captain and then also starring everybody else. So the captain goes first and then it's alphabetical.
I'm going to have to pay attention to the credits next time we watch.
Because Kate Mulgrew is not, like, her name is not the first, like Robert Beltran would be before her, really, if it were alphabetical. So it's always the captain and everybody else.
Okay,
no, the Chakotay is not credited before the captain. That'd be crazy. The captain's credited first and then everybody else.
Okay.
In Next Gen, I think it was like Patrick Stewart, Jonathan Frakes, and then everybody else. And of course, back in the original series, it was William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy. And then for the third season, it was William Shatner, or second, William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy, DeForest Kelly.
And then
everybody else was like in the end credits. As like also starring, right? Because there were no over the footage credits back then. Anyway, so Black Lightning continues to be really good.
Amazing show.
I'm not sure I have a lot to say about it. I still don't know what they're doing with the Lala character and why he's back. And why
I have to tell you something. I didn't like him in the beginning, but I got to tell you, this actor is bringing the heat because
not supposed to like him, but I know what you mean. I thought he was really good from the beginning. I thought he was a compelling character.
I thought he was compelling, but I thought it was a sort of ordinary, like doable. Like you could guess that a lot of actors could probably put out a good enough performance for those lines for that character, and I didn't really resonate with him a whole lot. And I was, you know, I totally bought into his performance. I thought it was great, but I didn't think he was challenged well enough. And it's not like he stuck out in my brain as a memorable character. But ever since he came back from the dead, his interactions, his persona, his body language, his delivery of all these lines,
he has a lot more layers to play back.
This guy is really good.
He's got the original layers of I want to be like a criminal kingpin.
Yes.
Plus the layers of I'm back from the dead, and I don't really understand why. It's unclear if he even understand that he's back from the dead. Because if a rational person saw ghosts or whatever visions, he'd be like, why am I seeing these people? But he acts like it's totally normal. He doesn't try to hide it from any of the other people around him. So it's unclear what he realizes about what's happening to him. So he's got that going on. Then there's whole scenes where we, the audience, don't see the people he's talking to, but he does. So he's got so much more to play.
He walks around with like zero F's to give, if I could just quantify his total demeanor.
Does he have a death wish now? Because he's like, he's sold his mother out. Basically,
that was crazy.
Risked her life at the very least, and then he's pulling these moves which seem incredibly risky.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if it weren't for the fact that Tobias Whale is probably going to come back and want his territory back,
right?
They'd still be incredibly risky moves, like putting all this up as collateral and saying, "Oh, I'm so convinced that the people on the streets are going to
want regular drugs
again that I'm basically mortgaging my entire future and life and my mother's life and so on on this." Yeah, it's really interesting.
Really interesting stuff. I love the interactions with the ladies of the show as well. The mother is really strong and so impressive. And Lynn is her name, right? So the doctor, she's a powerhouse. She's wonderful, empathetic. I love the storylines.
I think it's well balanced because some of the other shows sometimes feel like, I mean, Legends of Tomorrow doesn't really have like a clear star in the way that, say, Arrow and Flash do. Like, it's not named after one character.
Sure.
But sometimes, especially in Arrow, especially in some of the middle seasons there, like I guess 3, 4, 5, the cast got so big and there were so many other characters who were superheroes and who were prominent and sometimes were more interesting than the main character that Oliver kind of got lost a little bit, it seemed to me. Hasn't happened on Flash as much, but I feel like on this show, even though I feel like there have been episodes where Anissa or maybe even Jennifer and sometimes even Gambi have gotten maybe even more screen time than Jefferson has. It still doesn't feel out of balance. Like, he still feels like he's firmly the lead of the show.
Right.
I don't know if it's just his presence or the way it's written or what, but the show is able to develop the supporting character so thoroughly while still not losing sight of the fact that it's his story. You know, like, it can sort of divert into Anissa's story for a while, but it always like comes back to Jefferson's and dovetails with what he's doing in a way that doesn't feel like some weird sidetrack diversion, that like a plot cul-de-sac that doesn't go anywhere.
You know what else I noticed too? There have been thousands of shows, hundreds of instances where a character has said, I never asked for these powers, or I didn't want this, I never wanted to be, you know, have all of these amazing powers that I'm now whining about, blah, blah, blah. This is the first time when I see Jennifer struggling with this and the way her character is written and the way the actress performs it that I actually believe it. And it's so real and it's so relatable.
I've read too many X-Men comics.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You read it all the time. You watch it all the time. Oh, I never asked for this. And no, I don't really buy it.
I've seen it so many times that I don't bounce off of it anymore. Like, I just accept that as a trope. Like, I don't, it doesn't bother me anymore.
But that's what I'm saying. It doesn't feel like a trope here.
Yeah, to me. It's been well done, but it's never really been something that bothered. There's been times when a character has just been so whiny.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
There were times on Smallville where Clark was like that and it bothered me, but I think that's more just because it's a Superman character.
Seasons 1 through 9.
Well, no, I mean, it wasn't that bad. There were some of the middle seasons there where it seemed like he would be like, I don't want a Superman character to be like whiny and depressed and not, you know?
Yeah.
Not wanting to help people.
It was
you know, like, it wasn't what I wanted. But that was probably just my specifically because he was named Clark Kent. It wasn't necessarily any inherent flaw in the writing. But here, I think that what's interesting here is that Anissa is pushing her to be a hero.
Yes.
But we, the audience, I feel like, are not necessarily supposed to agree with that strategy.
Yes.
Like, it's right for Anissa, or I guess you could even argue that. But it's what Anissa wants to do, but it's not what she wants to do. So that's why I was so thankful for the scene where Jefferson comes in later and says, you know, I'm not saying this is going to be easy, but I'm here to promise you that I will make sure that you can still live your life the way you want, not the way other people want for you, or in any way that's dictated by what you've just learned about yourself.
That was so good. That was so powerful and such a beautiful parent-daughter moment, because it was like, I support you and life is hard and I can't protect you from everything. That was such a nice moment, because it's always rough for like a parent who wants to make sure their kid is doing well, and to see that interaction, like, I'm sorry, I can't protect you from everything in the world that's going to happen, and life is not always going to go your way and according to your plans and wishes, but it's here now, I'll help you cope, and you'll be okay. I promise you'll be okay.
It's interesting in the way that we're not necessarily supposed to agree with what Anissa is saying to her, because I feel like if this were one of the other shows, like take the Flash, right? How many times has someone got powers on the Flash?
Yep.
And our guys, you know, Barry and Caitlin and Cisco and whoever else is there, are always trying to tell them, you've got these powers, you're destined to be a hero. Like with Ralph, what's going on with Ralph right now? Like, anytime someone gets powers on the Flash, they try to convince them, like, it's just taken as a given that their ultimate destiny is to join the team and be a superhero.
Yeah.
It's not even a question, right?
Either that or supervillain. It's really two-dimensional. Like,
but even with the villains, if they think there's any in there, they'll try to get them to be a hero and, like, join their side, right? But so I feel like I don't necessarily want to say that this show is inherently more nuanced than, say, The Flash, but I feel like this particular subject matter...
It is a little bit.
Well, it can be, but I feel like it has the potential to be. But this show, I feel like it handled the specific plot point in that... Like, you know what I'm talking about. Like, how many times have we seen Barry go to someone and say, like, I can help you, I can train you, you know, you can be a hero, you can make a positive...
You don't see how good you are,
like, all that's true. Like, and that's... But that's very much in Barry's character,
yes.
right? Like, Barry's not a father. Like, he thinks... I don't know. It's interesting. I think it speaks...
He sees the best in people and wants to bring it out.
It speaks more to their characters. Like Barry is an inspirational figure.
Yes.
He doesn't even realize he's doing it. Jefferson is in a different way, but he comes at it from a father's protectiveness.
And it's wonderful.
He wants his daughter to live his own life. If this were...
Live her own life, yeah.
Yeah. If this were somebody else, if this were someone he's not related to, like if he, say, encounters, I don't know, like Metamorpho or, mm-hmm. you know, some other outsider character that they might bring onto the show, maybe he would sound more like Barry. He's like, don't you see, like, you can help me clean up the city or whatever. You've got these powers. You should
use
them.
And that's what he was trying to do with Lala at the very beginning. Like, I saw you when you were a student. We made an arrangement over here. He was trying to appeal to his better angels.
But that's sort of parental
in
a way, too, because that's coming from, like, the teacher-principal side of things. Where these are all kind of like his kids, you know? Like, this is his, he sees the whole community as like, especially the people who went to his school as like his wards, you know? Like, he's supposed to make sure they turn out okay.
But to your point, like, that is a parallel between him and Barry Allen in that he sees the best in them and he really does see that they can do good. And he wants to bring that out in the same way that Barry Allen wants to bring it out, too. So that's totally, that's a parallel right there.
Yeah, Jefferson, I feel like, though, and
but
maybe...
he's more realistic about
maybe
it,
maybe it's a character difference or maybe it's a writing difference. But Jefferson will actually, like, get in there and spend years, like, raising and teaching these kids and spending his weekends meeting with them one-on-one, like we saw with the kid in this episode, right? Where Barry will just sort of, like, give a speech.
Yeah.
And like, and he'll like, lead by,
I will change
he'll,
you by he'll one lead, conversation.
He'll lead by example. Yes. And we've seen lots of scenes of him like training Wally in Star Labs. And so it's not that he doesn't put in the work, but I feel like the show gives us more evidence that Jefferson is like in there in the trenches, rolling his sleeves up, helping these kids make a better life for themselves.
The
whereas
mantras,
Barry just sort of, as an inspirational, aspirational figure in the way that, say, like Superman is. But Superman, I mean, Clark Kent does, you know, stuff in his off time too, but Superman isn't like there in soup kitchens or whatever. You know, he isn't like volunteering at inner city schools on weekends helping kids, you know, like that's not, it's just not the way his character and his stories work.
Right.
So it's an interesting contrast. Anyway, so Legends of Tomorrow, this one was called I, Ava.
Yeah.
This one was a lot of fun. Part of me thought that they were jumping to conclusions. So they see
that's
that.
That's a spoilery title if there ever was one.
Well, yeah.
Isn't it?
Well, you think that this one's a spoilery title. Wait until you see next week's.
What's next?
No, it's spoilery in a fun way. I can tell you what it is after this. But so they realize that Ava has like this manufactured family life and history.
Yep.
And then they go to the future and see that there's a bunch of clones there, and they automatically jump to the conclusion that she is one of those clones and just hasn't told them. And then it turns out she's one of those clones and doesn't know it.
Right.
But part of me was like, wait, how do you know that's the explanation? Isn't it possible that she actually is from the present?
Right.
But then a couple hundred years from now, they use her DNA or whatever to create the perfect woman or whatever.
I had the same thought.
Why did they assume she was one of the clones? There's so many other possible explanations. It turned out they were right.
Yeah.
Although they didn't, they were wrong
about
how much she knew.
Yeah.
But and then like, there's so many other explanations.
That's a Plinkett review.
Maybe she goes on to be some great, you know, historical figure because of her work in the Time Bureau, or she saves the world or whatever. And so when they have to create this line of clones in a couple hundred years, they use her image, you know?
Yep.
In the same way that, you know, they might use like Barack Obama or so on if they wanted to create, I don't know. Like,
no, I agree with you. I had that same thought.
It turned out they were right. But anyway, it was a lot of fun. This show is always fun. And in the next week's episode, so of course, you know who's been playing the voice of Mollus, right? We've talked about this.
Forgot.
We talked about that. It's John Noble.
Yes.
We
talked about that. Okay. That was going to be my guess.
Next week's episode, the title of the episode is literally called Guest Starring John Noble.
What?
That is literally the title of the episode.
No,
so John Noble will be playing himself, John Noble, the actor.
Oh my God.
Much in the same way that they did episodes where they interacted with like a young George Lucas or whatever, right? They were going to interact with John Noble, the actor, in this episode.
Oh my God. You can't, okay, smarties, you can't see me right now, but literally my hands are at the side of my face, rubbing my temples from the shock. That's so cool.
So
I can't wait.
That should be a lot of fun. I can't imagine, I mean, I think it's just them having fun. I can't imagine there's going to be any in-story explanation for why this actor that they're interacting with sounds just like the great threat that they're facing. I can't imagine, maybe, but I think it's just supposed to be like a fun thing.
Oh my Lord.
That they're doing. I mean,
if you get
John Noble to do voiceover on your show, then
give
him an episode where he gets to just ham it up and have fun with the main cast.
Hilarious.
You know? So I feel like that's going to be
Do you think he's going to play like a really just ridiculous portrayal of himself, like he's the type of actor that orders green M&Ms in his dressing room or something ridiculous?
How,
are they going to ham it up that bad?
He seems like the kind of person who would have a sense of humor about himself, but I don't know how over the top they're going to go with it.
I think
I recall seeing a photo that showed him in like a wig and a robe, kind of like playing off more because I think the vast majority of people probably know him more, even though it was a relatively small role. For, no, I was going to say from Lord of the Rings. I think that even people don't remember that he was in that. I think more people have seen the Lord of the Rings movies than saw Fringe. I think that's undeniable. I mean, yeah, Return of the King won a Best Picture Oscar. I think more people are aware of that and have seen it than Fringe.
That's true.
Even though, obviously, Fringe, he was on for 5 years, and Lord of the Rings, he maybe had like a month of shooting or something. Sure. So, I think that maybe they might play that up more. Like, maybe he's on set in some, like, some fantasy, filming some fantasy movie and they show up. I don't know. I could be wrong about that. I seem to recall seeing a set photo where he had, like, a long gray wig and a robe or something.
Oh, ridiculous.
But it was a lot of fun. So, Arrow this week. This one was called the Thanatos Guild. So, Roy comes back. He wears a costume, which is, he wears, like, a hat and a jacket, similar to, like, his arsenal look from the comics. Well, I don't even know what that symbol on the hat is supposed to be. It's, like, this spiky thing, like, is it like a spiky shark or something? Like, it's supposed to be a sports team logo, I guess, but it's some fictitious
the Central City Sharks
with the exact same one as the one that he wore in the Red Hood and the Outlaws comic from I guess it's still going on now, but I'm not sure he wears that hat anymore, but throughout the original New 52 running wore that hat. Anyway, so the big thing about this episode is that that Thea leaves at the end. So we talked about how I thought it would be a good thing for her character to have a bit of a happy ending and go off and live with Roy, because her character's been through so much, and they gave her that, but they gave her also like a quest to go on. So I feel
I
like
that was cool.
I feel like it's good. It might have seemed a little pat for her to just be able to go off and with everything she's been through, and with, you know, the figure of importance she is in like the League of Assassins and, you know, the superhero community and everything else, and the fact that Roy is still like technically on the run, it might have seemed a little facile to say, oh, they just go off and live happily ever after together and nobody ever bothers them again or tries to contact them. So the fact that they're going to go off and be together but are still on this
in like, service of a quest, though,
I mean, it's clearly there mission. And they even said, the producers even said afterwards, like, you know, she's left the show, but of course anytime she wants to come back
she's more than welcome. She's more than welcome to open for that,
so, and she could even come back by herself or with Colton Haynes, depending. Like, she could be like, she could come back, either all three of them could come back or she could come back and so the others are still looking for the thing or whatever, but I've come back to help you with whatever.
Right.
I just hope that this means they haven't written the Nyssa character off the show too, because I kind of like Nyssa more than I like Roy or Thea. Is that wrong of me?
No, I'm in your boat, actually. Nyssa has a presence. She's
great. I would.
She's wonderful.
I mean, the ship has probably sailed now.
By the way,
probably
how funny was that husband stuff?
That stuff was great. I mean, part of me wonders if they'd made her a regular a couple of years ago, if her character would have gotten just gradually boring and sort of watered down.
But
you
this
know,
was funny. I've never seen the funniness.
If the show can sustain having her as a regular, without completely defanging her, I think part of what's cool is that she shows up periodically, like Boba Fett. She's just awesome. She shows up and then she leaves, and you're sort of left wanting more.
She's great.
I hope that that's not what happens with, say, Constantine next season on Legends of Tomorrow. The fact that he's there every episode, hopefully they won't just sort of, it won't become boring. Anyway, we'll see. But yeah, so I'm glad they wrote her out. They're off on this quest. I mean, I'd love to see them. I mean, what I think they should do, just for fun, if they can get both of them back in one episode, this is what I said last week, is have them show up on Legends of Tomorrow. Just have them interest. Then they both, and they gave Roy a different outfit here because Thea had his hood or whatever, but have them both show up in like their matching red and black outfits. That would be so awesome.
Yeah.
You know?
That'd be
and
cool.
I think that it'd be cool to have an art. You've got a speedster on the team now. Yep. I guess you've got Sarah, who is, she's not an archer, but she's like a former Arrow
expert
cast
fighter
member. So she's sort of from that world. But it'd be cool to have like a speedster and an archer on that show.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I don't know. If she wanted to be a regular on one of these shows, she wouldn't have left Arrow, right? So I don't think they're going to get Willa Holland to sign up as a regular on Legends of Tomorrow. But if the two of them could show up, or if you get Colton Haynes for a couple of episodes, like you got Matt Ryan for a couple of episodes this season, I'd really like to see them again on that
I thought
show.
It was a really nice, poignant way to say goodbye to Thea, too, because not only that, but like you said, saying, oh, happily ever after in Bluehaven or question mark or wherever, that would have been a little bit too... That would have been nice.
I would have been okay with it.
I would have been all right with it.
It would have seemed a little too pat.
A little, here's a lovely bow for this lovely package.
I think we're trained as TV viewers that when they tell us that a character leaves and lives happily ever after, we know enough about what's happening behind the scenes that the actor is leaving the show that we just sort of implicitly be like, okay, you know, fine, they're going to live happily ever. Like, whether it makes sense or not, we have to believe them because we know we're not going to see that character again.
But of all the ways to write her off the show, I appreciate two things about it. One, Willa's character. Yeah, Willa's character always wants to do right and wants to help in some way. And so she wants to help in this mission that's bigger than herself. And two, the fact that she believes in this mission even more than running off and into her happily ever after is so strong of her, But it's also nice, it's also really lovely and supportive and loving that he wants to follow her.
Right. Well, it's not just that it's a superhero mission. I think that it was specifically tied to the League of Assassins and Malcolm Merlyn.
Yeah.
I think that it's a good note for her to character, because her whole thing of her many, you know, arcs over the show, one of the main things has been like, is she a Merlyn or is she a queen? Like, is she more like her father or is she more like, say, her brother, right?
Right.
And what, by sort of bringing her arc to this conclusion where she gets to be with Roy, she gets to be a hero, but she's going to try to like save and redeem her father's legacy.
Yeah.
Her father died after all he put her through. Her father ultimately did die for her.
Yeah.
And that's not nothing.
Yeah.
So she's going to make sure that his legacy doesn't get completely perverted by this other thing.
Yeah.
And that's sort of her. So I think that it brings all the different sort of threads of her character together, from her love interest to her family relationships to her whole thing becoming in it, to the fact that she was resurrected and had those anger issues to the relationship with the League of, what was it on this show? The League of Assassins on this show, right?
On this one,
this is why it confuses me. And then her father
as
and all that.
Led by some lady named Athena with a face scar. Okay.
Yeah, I think she's from the comics, but I can't remember.
Must be. I just don't.
Yeah, so I liked that it brought all that together. So I think that was well done.
Agreed. You know, this week, I'll also add, it was the week of blood keys. Did you notice? On Krypton, he needed to cut his hand to open something.
I feel like that's just a genre thing.
It's just such
thing.
A trope, yeah.
Like,
as soon as they saw the letter and they said, only you can open it, I'm like, oh, she has to sprinkle some blood on it.
I knew
I was
going to be blood.
You
can't watch two episodes of Star Trek without somebody cutting their hand open either. So,
well,
usually Klingons.
Yeah, I know. They're all about that. That's their first test. But in their defense, the Dominion with the...
No, I understand why, but I read something from a doctor once. It was like, that's actually, there's so many tendons you could cut.
Yes.
When you cut, like,
seriously.
Just literally, just like, you know, prick your arm or something, or your fingertip or something. Like, don't literally
slice
open your palm. Like,
yeah,
that's so dangerous. You can get permanent, you know,
permanent
severing of
damage.
Muscles and tendons.
I mean, the realistic show would be like, nobody can actually have functional use of their hands anymore because they've cut them. Yeah, no Klingon would be able to grip any mug of blood wine anymore. Anyway, yeah.
So that's it for all of our shows.
Yeah, it was a good batch of shows. Okay, so hopefully you enjoyed the ride. If you want to reach out to the show, we have an email address, mailbag@smartspodcast.com. Our website is www.smartspodcast.com. Our Twitter handle is @smartspodcast. And on Facebook, it's facebook.com/smartspodcast. And we promise we won't steal your information. Topical reference. How about a funny joke or a funny sound? Or
I can't think of one.
How about, cha-ching!
Ooh.